Okay, remember that the outline is a fairly annotated outline, so you don't have to take a whole bunch of notes if you printed it. It's what I'm going from as well, so I'll stick fairly close to it, and it will not be a reiteration of the curriculum. The syllabus will be the pairing of the reading with what we'll be doing each of the 12 seminars. So that will keep you on track to look at what might be helpful. I would also suggest that as you do the reading, that you do the exercises and work tools yourself to really see what that may be like, the very best way that we have of understanding and co-creating a new story with a client is to understand our own story, to know ourselves quite well. And you'll also be able to see in doing the exercises and work tools what you might want to use with clients. Now, as you look at the curriculum, most of you have the curriculum. A couple of you who registered late, I sent the PDF of the curriculum of the first couple of weeks, so you'd have that and not get behind. You'll notice that there are portions that are in gray. That's the workbook. Those components that are in gray are going to be in the workbook. That's a client workbook that is just the tools and the exercises along with the necessary explanation and framing about what they're about. So those are the aspects that will be in the client workbook. If you choose to use that client workbook, you will be licensed to use that workbook and can have it co-branded with your name on the cover and a new first page for information and that sort of thing. So that's a tool that you can have that can be useful for either individual or especially for groups. And that 28-week protocol is one way of looking at how can you sort of apportion the workbook assignments to fit with coaching sessions or coaching groups that you have. That's simply one way to do it. It can be expanded or contracted. And I particularly avoided that at first because I don't really use the workbook with clients I work with except to maybe look at an exercise at one point or a work tool at another. But I was nudged by a number of people who trained with me to create that 28-week protocol, and it's a way to sort of pair the sessions, say, in a group or individually with work tools and components of the workbook, and to look at any component of that that you like. If somebody wants to work on their money story, then you can look at the roadmap, the 7 steps to understand how to listen to and deconstruct a story and how to create a new one, plus the money story. So this is kind of a preface question, and I'll go on lecture mode in a moment. So, you know, I appreciate you guys managing the background noise. You're doing a super job. How many of you know how to program a computer to write new code? Anybody?
Nope.
Well, you're about to learn. The 7 steps, the acronym, the roadmap, is 7 steps about how to deconstruct a process of understanding a story and a systematic way of constructing a new one. So the roadmap system is really to understand the algorithms of the mind and the brain. You know, it's been said, and we know now from neuroscience, that about 90 to 95% of our operating systems are unconscious. And that means that so many of the patterns that we engage in, the attachment patterns, behavior patterns, emotional patterns, the default modes that we operate on a daily basis, only 5 or 10% of that is conscious. And the remainder is determined by certain algorithms that we only see the result of, that we only see, say, the behavioral manifestation or the way that somebody has an attachment pattern, that they typically engage in certain relationships in certain ways and repeat them without even needing, in most instances, to be consciously aware of them. So what we do in coaching is we can use this material, we can use the mind and brain sciences to help inform our listening and our understanding and ways of collaborating with clients to look at the things and understand the ones that work and the ones that don't work. And basically, the most fundamental way of thinking about things in coaching is, if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. So that's a sort of preface. We're going to spend the first seminar today as a prologue to the work to talk about the power of story and the concept of writing a new story. And the remaining seminars, we're going to look at how to do that. And we're going to spend the next four seminars to really understand the roadmap process. It's a systematic way of understanding and creating a new story or revising a story. And then we're going to apply it to specific aspects. Money story, wellness story, relationship story, career story, that sort of thing. So this is why I believe it will be helpful to do the exercises and work tools and use those as ways to reflect on your own story. When you've made your own journey, you can best guide a client's journey. This is from a Chinese proverb. I hear and I forget. I see and I remember. I do and I understand. And from Columbia University, we remember 2% of what we hear, 25% of what we see, and 90% of what we do. So this is a way to think about a more optimum performance. When we put it in an output channel, we retain better and we remember better. There have been a number of studies about this. Whenever you read a book, if you simply passively read it, you'll retain better and remember more if you put it in an output channel to complete that circuit in your brain, to write it down or outline it or do something so that it's in an output channel, and you're going to have better grasp and mastery of that. So I'm going to move us to a lecture mode now, and then we'll have time, as always, at the end to discuss questions, thoughts, comments, anything that relates at all, or it may not have to relate if it's interesting enough, and we'll talk about it and come back for discussion mode. Okay, so I would suggest that you begin with doing this. Write this question down. What is my story? I'd suggest you schedule a brainstorming session with yourself. Think about your story. It makes you who you are. Summarize your plot in one sentence. Bullet your major storylines. Now, this is not your bio, your title, your role. This is your story. One of the things you bring as professional coaches that is unique, you're experts at change. You are choice architects. You facilitate and guide a client's life or wellness story. And as we go through the seminars, think about your professional story. Work on how to convey your unique offering in a clear, brief, simple way that focuses on the benefits the client will get. At a meeting not too long ago, I heard David Plouf, who originally was Obama's chief campaign strategist, who conducted his internet approach. Plouf put it this way: be able to answer every crucial question in one sentence. Einstein said, if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. And Seth Godin sort of doubled down Einstein and said, if you can't state your position in 8 words or less, you don't have a position. So here are some premises that our work together will be based on. 1. Plot is the structure, purpose, and pattern of a story. This is really a way of talking about how the metaphor of story may be a very useful way to consider how to understand your own story and the story of clients, how to listen in a better and more informed way. For a life story, plot is the outline of life narratives. The core assumptions of life stories inform what people look for and then how they attribute meaning to what they experience. As I mentioned, behavioral patterns, belief systems, attachment patterns are downloaded, especially from parents, in the first years of life to become automatic, to operate without even awareness and barely with observation. So, as we talk about our operating system being 90 to 95% unconscious, what this means is that we can create two stories simultaneously. The surface story, the conscious story, that we run our lives with conscious intentions and aspirations. This includes what we're aware of. This is what I want from life. These are my goals. At the same time, an unconscious story can ghostwrite behaviors, at times in a different direction from conscious intention. So when life and actions don't meet your positive aspirations, look to the shadow story. It could be, I can't get what I want. The system keeps me from doing what I need. I don't have what it takes. A very simple example is a conscious goal may be, I want to generate more income and ultimately create wealth. But the shadow story could be a belief system that is not conscious and comes from a long time ago. I don't think I have what it takes. Or wealth isn't really spiritual. Or what if I try my hardest and then I don't make it and I'll be horribly embarrassed. So what we need to be aware of is, if there is a surface story and a shadow story, if they go in opposite directions, it can create a stuckness. So this is part of what we listen for. The belief systems that and the hidden assumptions that manifest in our client's story. We'll talk more about how to do that specifically. Number two, we learn through stories. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. James Watson, the guy who discovered DNA with Crick, said, you know, I can remember something when I fit it into a story. A story is a system for holding together facts. A story makes things make sense. Muriel Rukeyser said, the world is made up of stories, not atoms. Think about how we personify the economy or the stock market, as if each were a story of its own. The market rebounded on the news. The economy is holding closely on to, we make a story out of events in order to infer a relationship and assign causality. Number three of premises that comprise a story. We each have a personal story with a plot and storylines. Our beliefs and assumptions ghostwrite that story. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our software determines what we perceive and then how we process it. The brain needs a story. It will infer one, so it's helpful to know the lexicon. Our plot consists of our core beliefs and assumptions that transform all available information into a system that makes sense. Then we create life narratives according to that plot, since mind and brain both are programmed to process by the default mode and to ignore facts that contradict our assumptions. We have a belief, in other words, that something is going to happen, or just a simple belief system, and we then seek data to prove that, a confirmation bias. We give inattention blindness to anything that contradicts it. We don't pay attention to anything that contradicts it, so it makes our story come to be true. I'll give you an example of that in just a moment. Four, a life story contains silent assumptions and emotional scripts. Our assumptions tell us what to look for and how to perceive and process experiences. In other words, our radar is coded to perceive certain things and give selective inattention to others. Here's an example. about how some of our beliefs and patterns may be invisible even to ourselves. Gregory Maguire, a best-selling novelist and playwright, most recently the Broadway hit Wicked, said, "You know, I didn't even realize this at first, but there's no central character in any of my 24 books who doesn't have a dead mother or a lost parent." Maguire's mother died from complications during his birth. After his 23rd book, he became conscious, finally, of the fact that, as he put it, "I realized I can't seem to start a novel unless the character doesn't have a mother. If the mother's still alive, the mother's still there, what's the problem? There's nothing to write about." 5. We believe, and again, this is all in your outline. We believe and remember only that which fits our plot. What we expect to happen in the present reveals instantly our experience in the past. Psychoanalysts call this transference. For example, someone abandoned early in life will expect more of the same in future relationships, even though the circumstances change. And then they bring it about because all subsequent information is absorbed, filtered, and organized by that narrative plot. Our expectations help us see things, in fact, determine what we see, and, as I mentioned, they may blind us to things that we're not looking for. Here's a really simple example. A professor who's fond of telling stories will ask his class, close to the end of class, if they have time for him to tell them a story before they leave. They look at their watches and inevitably say yes, they love his stories. Well, he immediately asked them then what time it is. Every one of them had to look at their watches again. And this is completely understandable because the frame of reference for the initial question was how much time remained, not what time it was. So the first time they looked to see if there was enough time left before the class ended. If we look for one thing, we may miss another. 6. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. We see what we believe, and we're always right, because we write the story. Here's an example, a true story a number of years ago out of Oxford. Two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They each had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. They entered the ape colonies not communicating with each other, not knowing what each other was doing. And then after 1 year, they emerged to compare notes. They expected essential similarities, but instead, there were remarkable discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes. He was integrated into the colony, achieved a real unity and comfort and connection with the apes, got remarkable data. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony. He remained careful and vigilant, always seemed right on the cusp of a conflict, never achieved that harmony and comfort. Well, the anthropologists didn't understand the discrepant results or find any reasons for it. They puzzled for months. They and their teams puzzled for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it. But he knew he had it. He knew if things got tough, he had an out. The other anthropologist had no gun. He had no out. He had a commitment. He knew from the beginning he was either going to make it or not on his own. And in retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, and then our story tells us. 7. A story can define possibility. Now, each of you guys knows this story, and it's been prominent in the news in the last few days because the subject, Dr. Roger Bannister, just died. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. Scientists and physicians said it was physically impossible. Then in 1954, Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile. Within the following 18 months, 12 other people broke the 4-minute mile as well. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. Today, this is commonplace. When the mindset of what's possible changes, reality then changes as well. In fact, and I think this is hilarious, and I just fairly recently found this other component to the story. He had been told that whenever, if anybody ever came in under 4 minutes, which is actually physically impossible, it would kill them. They would die. So as soon as Bannister actually finished the mile, he collapsed. And then when he came to, his question was, am I dead? Which totally makes sense. 8, a story can define reality. A placebo generates the effect of the accompanying story. A patient is prescribed an inert pill plus some expectations, in other words, a story. In the majority of cases, the story becomes the reality. By anticipating an experience, we can create it. The story generates a truth so powerful it can even reverse the actual pharmacological effect of a real medicine. Not a placebo effect, but a real medicine, the effect can be reversed by the story. The placebo is a white lie. It's a fiction that becomes a truth. In fact, a very recent MIT study showed that a more expensive placebo worked significantly better than a cheaper one. Same placebo, different stories. Now, this isn't about being gullible or suggestible, but when a patient believes something will reduce pain, the body releases endorphins. And medical research has even suggested that over 70% of successful non-surgical treatments are the result of the patient's belief that the treatment will work. And of course that's predicated on the physician's belief that's passed on to the patient that it will work. 9, a story can take over the author. Listen to these expressions. My anger took over. My fear stopped me. A feeling that someone creates is perceived to act on the creator. This is a way of seeing ourselves as the victims of something we create rather than the author of it. My doubt paralyzed me. My work eroded my free time. My weight gets in the way. We ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creations and even perceive ourselves as the victim of the story or the feeling that we just created. So all of these things, this is a sidebar here, but in bold brackets. These are all aspects of when you're listening to a client's story. These are all coachable moments. In fact, with every client who I work with, I request very early on in the process, may I interrupt you at any point if I feel that it would be valuable for us to look at this or focus on it? And inevitably, they say yes, and I also give them permission to interrupt me if there's something I've said that's not clear or that they want to focus on and expand, then they interrupt me. So it's a very active and dynamic process that I don't have to wait the socially acceptable, you know, 3 or 4 paragraphs until they take a breath. We look at it right then, and we know we're going to be working on it from the very beginning. So think about each of these as coachable moments. Another example of the power of story is a woman I know who recalled an incident many, many years ago from her adolescence. She attended an all-girls Catholic boarding school, and she said, "At one party, I started a rumor that the punch was spiked, and everybody got drunk." Number 10, your life is the self-statement, the manifestation of what exists inside you. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say and do is about yourself. What you say about me tells me about you. Everyone is always making self-statements. So this is a way of knowing that your client is doing the very best job possible of showing you what it's like to be them, because everything they say is about themselves, even though the focus may be on you or somebody else, and the process that's created with you in the relationship also is a way of showing you things they may not even be aware of. You know, that 90% or more of unconscious, that has to come, that has to surface in some ways, and it will. Now, look in the, when you have a moment, there's a glossary in the curriculum that has a number of the terms that I use, and it's kind of an excuse to, put there some of my favorite quotes. I'm a consummate collector of quotes. But look specifically at self-statement in the glossary. It will explain a little bit more of what we're talking about here. So, a client is always showing you exactly what it's like to be him or her. And if you think about it that way, rather than seeing it as resistance, it can help you understand how to engage. And we'll return to that. 11. When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Neuroscience shows us that pure facts are a myth. Quantum physics seconds the motion. This observation came originally from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks, but it's true for every coach-client engagement. And number 12, I think this is huge. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends their usual thinking and performance. Think about that. I want to say it again. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain, visible on fMRI scan, to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. What that means is the most important thing, in my view, that we can do for our clients is to believe in them, and then they'll come to show us both why. So that's why I wouldn't work with someone in whom I didn't believe. Now, this principle comes from neuroscience, even though good parents have known it for centuries. We'll talk about how that works later and how to work it. Now, I expect you'll have questions about some of what I've just said. And because when questions are raised, your minds and brains will work on solutions. We'll strive for closure. One closure is to attach familiar associations and put it in the familiar container. Let's call that the old story. Another is to keep it open and remain in curious exploration of new meanings and possibilities. A new story. This is what we hope to do with clients. This is what I'm hoping each of you will do as you self-reflect as we're going through this process. And each of the points that I've just raised are themes that we'll return to, develop, and weave together throughout this experience. So let's look for just a moment at how our minds and brains work, a very fundamental principle. Why do we resist change? Even changing a story that doesn't work. What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will somebody repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, and expect a different result? Kind of like somebody who doesn't understand English, you repeat English louder as if louder is going to work. Even when the story that doesn't work leads to lower energy, debt, plateaued careers, or disappointing relationships, someone may keep repeating it, hoping that it's going to work. Nassim Taleb asks in his book, The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So, part of the answer to why we resist change, and this is fundamental for what we're doing as coaches, is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. A comfort zone may be limiting or uncomfortable. It's familiar. It's our default model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out, and that can create the illusion of effectiveness. Repetition can masquerade as effectiveness. On the other hand, a new story generates uncertainty and trepidation. And the easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. You know, think about you're on the edge of the swimming pool to jump in to learn to swim for the first time. You're going to have to tolerate anxiety, uncertainty, lack of confidence because you don't know how to do it yet. You jump in despite that, and then you experience ultimately effectiveness and mastery. On the other hand, if you back away, you immediately treat the anxiety. But the next time you get to the same place, it'll be at least as anxiety-provoking, and it will not have resulted in mastery. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal map synonymous with identity. The P of roadmap, the last step of the roadmap, is to program new identity. This is what makes change permanent, because our identity, let me say that a different way, the most powerful force of the human psyche is to return to our identity. So if changes and different ways of behaving are not incorporated as a transition to the model of how and who we are and what we operate on, in other words, our identity, we'll return to the old model. We'll talk about systematically how to do that. So let's do just a very brief exercise. Put your palms together and interlock your fingers very firmly. Now, keep your fingers firmly together, but change so that the other thumb is on top. How's that feel? Kind of awkward, kind of goofy. Now, move your thumbs back to the original place. Kind of a relief. That's why people don't change. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, such as a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We'll talk more about comfort zones and how to program change. There is always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Now, the other part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a really circuitous path, zigzags and indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well worn, despite it being really circuitous, a lot of twists and turns. No one started a new, more direct route. And he gradually got more twists and turns, more circuitous. Not a single person created a new path, no matter how circuitous and diabolical it was. They always followed the path of least resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain. By early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous routes. So to think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. This is where we come in. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, a new context, looking at things in a different way, a powerful question. That's what we're experts at choice architecture, at looking at each moment and the choice of this moment. And And we're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar and engage in new behavior, the newness, the uncertainty, can be read as the discomfort means and an old model, danger ahead, better head for cover. But somebody is not seeing that as an old model. They're seeing it as the way things are. So it makes sense when there's perceived to be danger ahead to head for cover, or simply to end the uncertainty and the anxiety, see it as evidence not to proceed, or even as intuition of a wrong choice. So this is how we began to help someone make a transition in terms of their operating model, their identity, to reframe things in the present moment, where anxiety is not danger ahead, better head for cover, or this is intuition of a wrong choice, but this is validation that you're moving ahead. It's a signpost, the experience validating new happenings, new progress. So in a very current context, it's reinterpreted, reframed as a way of validating growth. And this is what's then internalized. So ultimately, your client won't need you. This is a process they've learned to see and reflect on themselves, because you together have been doing that for some time. So discomfort and uncertainty, lack of confidence, begin any significant journey. In fact, our brains even have an error detection mechanism. It's located very close to the emotional center. It's an actual location in the brain that says, when we try something new, this isn't normal. We'll talk about how to use this mechanism to make it a powerful internal navigation system. So what this means is, not only do we actively construct stories, but our brain continually edits at the same time. And this is a classic study, and I'm sure you guys have seen this this study. An audience is asked to watch several people dribbling and passing a basketball among themselves. Their job, to count the number of passes each person makes during a one-minute period. Intense concentration is needed because there are two balls and they move quickly. Then someone in the middle of this process, dressed in a gorilla suit, crosses the floor, walks through the players, turns to the viewer, thumps his chest in the middle of the screen, and then leaves. Well, this is so obvious. How many people saw it? Slightly less than 50%. Researchers Daniel Simons and Christopher Shabris found that over 50% of failed to notice the gorilla. This inattentional blindness is our brain at work trying to construct meaningful and consistent narratives in an inconsistent world. Things that don't fit the storyline get unconsciously edited or simply fail to register as relevant. So, listen for the power of story. Our brains can rewire. New experiences practiced consistently form new neuronal pathways and new neural networks. And some remarkable new research shows both beliefs as well as repeating new experiences can both alter gene expressions. So, when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Metaphors and narratives become brain structures. Also from the Black Swan, ideas come and go, stories change. I'm sorry, say that again. Ideas come and go, stories stay. I need to operate from a script rather than outline. One thing to remember, and I'm sure you've experienced this if you've experienced any mentor coaching or in work with clients, a client does not experience what they're talking about as their story. It's just the way things are. This is our metaphor to understand and to engage someone in a collaborative way to look at something and understand it. But that's part of the work itself, to really look at it together, to develop that working alliance, to understand, reflect on, and then engage in strategic change. So, I want to describe a study and have you guess the biggest change impact. Now, a couple of you have done some training with me, probably have heard this story. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects chose a different option from poles of contrasting behaviors, like lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, talking about sports, talking about business. They chose one of these options and behaved according to this choice the entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they would eat something they had never eaten before, and twice weekly they would read something they had never read before. So what do you think the biggest change in this group was? The remarkable finding was that after 4 months, the subjects had lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, they had kept the weight off. Many continued to lose weight. Now, the researchers, Fletcher and his group, were baffled. This wasn't a diet. It was a study focusing on change and its impact. Then they looked very carefully at what happened. Asking people to change routine behavior made them actually think about decisions rather than in a default way, habitually choosing that default mode without consideration. So basically, in coaching, I'd call this story busting. When the participants processed decisions actively, they exercised choice. So, in other words, what this meant was that instead of just routinely deciding something, for example, with eating, they became consciously aware of what they eat, and almost every person became aware of each bite so that they began to ask, is this bite in my best interest? And they became aware then of mindfulness eating, where they reflected on and processed each thing instead of mindlessly eating and thinking about other things and not even listening to their body while they're doing that. And this process of conscious decision extended to other things, other choices. So as coaches, we're choice architects to help a client be aware that a choice right now in this moment is exactly what he or she is creating. It's not there until it's created. Once becoming aware of actively making choices, then you can decide what's in your best interest, what furthers your story and what doesn't. If you want to understand something, try to change it. Now, here's a brief vignette to apply this from mentor coaching. Brian was working successfully at a new CEO position. 3 months earlier, he advanced from COO at another corporation, and he was doing a great job in his first 100 days. One session, he departed from our discussion of success strategies to say he had a fear he was somehow going to sabotage his new achievements. He said that he regularly stopped at a convenience store to eat candy before he got home so his wife wouldn't see him. I asked how he decided to stop each time. He responded by calling it sneak eating and said he hadn't told his wife. And I refocused on exactly what was going on in his mind, the frame before he decided. I said, what do you say to yourself the instant that you decide to stop? Well, he wasn't sure. He hadn't really looked at it. I wanted to know specifically the conversation he was having with himself that led to his conclusion, I'm going to get the candy. In other words, the frame before you decide to stop, are you bargaining with yourself to say, well, I'll do better or I'll stop doing this next Tuesday? Do you oppose your own authority to say, well, hell with it, I'm going to do whatever I want? Or do you feel some overwhelming urge that hijacks your best judgment? Well, Brian recognized the conversation with himself that went, to hell with it, I'm going to eat whatever I want. Nobody's around to stop me. He recognized the result was to abandon his own principles, to oppose his own authority. And I highlighted that in the story he was writing, he was opposing his own authority, and he farmed out his authority to his wife, as if she were the obstacle. He kept the other half, the desire, as if he were getting away with something. He created the illusion that he triumphed because his wife didn't see him. We touched on his stress in being a more ultimate authority now than he'd ever been before in his life, his first CEO position. He acknowledged his choice to not be his own authority when he stopped and got the candy. His question was, how do I get it back? And I said, well, the question is not how do you get it back, but how do you not give it away? It's yours. You're the author of your story. And I added, it sounds like you're not being loyal to yourself. And he recognized he was writing a storyline he detested. Then we looked at how to align what he did with his own needs and his own ideals. There's a exercise for this in Module 1, which you'll be reading for next seminar, where we could apply this process to expand the success he was having in his company to the success in his own life as his own more ultimate authority now than he'd been ever before, and to create a specific plan with strategies for both eating and at my nudging exercise. So, in summary now, here are some principles to focus on facilitating change. This is a preface to looking at creating a new story. One, each person's life story is created. In adulthood, we create whatever we think, feel, and experience each moment. Every day is a blank page until you write on it, even though it may seem like it's just the way things are. Two, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. Three, when people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. This establishes the beginning of effectiveness and mastery. The antithesis, somebody tells you what to do. We'll talk in a later session about how with an aha moment or a moment of insight, three different parts of the brain light up and someone is vaulted into a state of mind that's more synthetic and creative and integrative. It becomes their own story. Whenever somebody tells them what to do, gives information, gives orders, no part of the brain lights up. Four, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. Assumptions manifest as feelings and behaviors. And when you make assumptions explicit, you can more clearly see which facilitate and which interfere. Kind of like the anthropologist. Five, change is constant and inevitable. It's the resistance to change that generates most problems. Think about that. Six, small changes lead to big changes. Issues that may seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue in order to specify progress. This is kind of the bread and butter of coaching, something that we learned very early on. When you feel overwhelmed with the amount of tasks, clarify one issue that, if done today, would be progress. What's the next best action? This model facilitates effectiveness and initiates a model of mastery to shrink the change, to look at the next step to get traction. Seven, problems, causes, and solutions are not always related or even interconnected. To resolve a problem, even emotionally, to come to the end of the past, does not create a blueprint for success. That's why there are a lot of frustrated therapy refugees. Strategic plans for specific goals are necessary. If something's a totally new experience, you may need a guide, even something for a healthier diet or exercise, or different components of what you do that's different. Eight, The benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what's not will become evident and self-perpetuating. 9. You need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. Setting a goal will enhance motivation. Having a goal helps you know where you are, where you're going, how to measure progress along the way, and what's detour and distraction. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do. So the end should be in mind from the beginning. Lewis Carroll said it really well. Alice came to a fork in the road. "Which road do I take?" she asked. "Where do you want to go?" responded the Cheshire Cat. "I don't know," Alice answered. Then said the cat, "It doesn't matter." 10. You need the correct paradigm. A paradigm is an internal map. It's the way you see, interpret, and understand something. It's analogous to a mindset. It needs to be correct. If you're in Dallas and need to navigate the city, a map of Houston is useless no matter how hard you try. So the paradigm needs to be current, not a paradigm from an old story or old outdated software tailor-made for an earlier situation. 11. Decide what you want. Believe it's possible. A belief is a filter between reality and our perception, sort of like the filter on a camera that alters the image that gets recorded by the camera. We now know that beliefs can actually turn genes on and turn them off. You can change your life by changing your beliefs. Our possibilities are only limited to the ones we allow ourselves to see. And here's, in closing, one example of a belief coupled with a goal. A destitute young housewife had almost no money. She couldn't afford a babysitter or a computer, but she had a story to tell, and she was determined to tell it. So she decides to write. As soon as she starts writing, her mother dies at age 45 from multiple sclerosis. Her marriage to an abusive husband ends in a divorce. She has a miscarriage. She gets fired from her job and lives on government welfare. She takes her baby to a coffee shop in the middle of the afternoon and writes on a legal pad while her baby takes a nap. She does this every day for 4 years. And then, after much work, she finally found a publisher for Harry Potter.